In May 1977, when President Carter came to London, there was a bit of a row created over what should have been a fairly simple thing: how the British would address the new American chief of state. His name was James Earl Carter, so protocol would call for James E. to be used on invites and official correspondence. But in all his communications, the president insisted on using his nickname, Jimmy. The idea of the Court of St. James calling an American president Jimmy was incomprehensible for some there. Yet it was a conundrum. This is how their guest of honor wanted to be addressed. How could they not comply? In the end, Prime Minister Callaghan, the Queen, and those at Buckingham Palace greeted the new president as Jimmy. Carter shocked the world, being the first president before since to use a nickname when taking the oath of office. We can't imagine Reagan getting sworn in as Ronnie or William Jefferson Clinton as Billy. But he said it: "I, Jimmy Carter, do solemnly swear." That's what Chief Justice Warren Burger asked him to repeat, and what he said to the nation. The public ate it up. They also liked when, halfway through the inauguration parade, Carter stopped the car and got out and walked the rest of the way to the White House. Drove the Secret Service crazy, but delighted the crowd of people who came out for the inauguration and earned the respect of politicians. Jimmy Carter's political task was not unlike Warren Harding's. It was an appeal to normalcy. As Hugh Seide said, after Nixon and Watergate and the Ford pardon, Americans were looking to scale things down, to lower the scale for simplicity. And on this, Jimmy Carter delivered. His pollster Pat Caddell said people wanted a citizen president, and Carter followed Caddell's strategy. He carried his own bags. He sold the presidential yacht, a nice little boat called the Sequoia, and transferred some of the 20-plus Air Force One planes back to the Air Force. He reduced the size of the White House staff and stopped the playing of Hail to the Chief, the trappings of the imperial presidency that he wanted to lose. All of this culminated in wide support for the citizen Jimmy, who walked down Pennsylvania into the White House to fix things. 75% approval rating in the Gallup poll when he took off. Indeed, when Jimmy asked for a few things from Congress, his own Democratic Congress: the ability to deregulate energy sales to encourage producers to sell their energy out of state, bringing the price down, he got it from Congress. When he asked to reorganize the executive branch, something that not all members of Congress were thrilled with, he got what he wanted early on. As Carter solved one problem, making people feel more closer to their government, there were others. In 1977, energy was among the largest concerns. Prices were high and supply low. The percentage of foreign supply increasing near 50%. Unemployment was lower than it is today at 6%, but still high. Inflation, partially the result of energy and health care, fueled uncertainty. These were the problems Americans demanded that Jimmy solve. Then there was the politics. Despite his high approval rating, Carter had beat incumbent President Ford by 2%, not a high amount, and had benefited from a group of Republican crossovers. Ford actually cut into some of the traditional Democratic groups, like Catholics, and Jimmy Carter had not brought a whole lot of Democratic congressmen with him. In one way, 1976 was parallel to 2008 because Democrats had 2 years before made big gains in the 1974 election. And that was a tidewater year. It was the year of Watergate, just as 2006 was. It was a midterm in which Democrats gained a lot of seats. They'd already owned the House, but new Democrats were elected to Congress, beating Republicans associated with Nixon and Watergate. And these new congresspeople were more liberal. In 1976, they continued the gains and held the House, but only with a few seats. And that makes it a little different from 2008, where Democrats made additional gains. No one saw Carter as the key to congressional victory. Relations with the new Speaker, Tip O'Neill of Massachusetts, the unanimous choice of his body to take over after Speaker Carl Albert, did not start off on a good foot. As O'Neill saw it, when Carter talked about old-style politics that he was going to get rid of in the campaign and during his transition, Tip O'Neill knew who he was talking about. Carter, O'Neill said, and the Carter people were talking about me. And that was the way things were. He understood campaign rhetoric. But he expected that Carter and his people would drop it after the election. But in a post-election meeting with O'Neill, Carter spent a large amount of time talking about how he could work around Congress if need be. O'Neill realized that Jimmy was more than just rhetoric. He was going to change things in Washington if he could, and fast. This new White House didn't act the way other White Houses in the past had, certainly not how the Nixon or Ford administrations had. Those administrations consulted with members of their party in Congress when making executive branch appointments. With the Carter administration, the focus was on merit. If a Republican would do the job well, they would keep the Republican there. Appointments were made without consulting with members of Congress from the states where the employees came from, or without consulting with relevant committee heads. And some of the key people in the Carter administration, Burt Lantz, Griffin Bell, Stu Eisenstadt, Jody Powell, and Ham Jordan, were from Georgia. The press was already calling them the Georgia Mafia. But for the new president, these were the people that had helped him win an unlikely, an improbable victory from an unknown to the leader of the free world. How could they not be the people that he now relied on when he got in? Tip O'Neill was not impressed by them. He said they were good at winning an election, and that's about it. Carter told a group of visiting Congress people during his early days as president that he, as the governor of Georgia, spoke directly to the people whenever he needed to, whenever he didn't get what he wanted from the legislature. And then he said to them, "I can speak to your constituents better than you can." That didn't sit well with the Congress people or those they told the story to. Sometimes Carter is thought of or criticized for lacking confidence as a president. And in his later years, we might have seen some of that. Not in 1977. Confidence was not a problem for the former Navy officer. No matter what the naysayers in Washington said, Jimmy was going to change things. One story is emblematic of the way the Carter administration and Congress worked or didn't work together. Early on in Carter's presidency, Tip O'Neill was supposed to get, as members of Congress do, front row tickets to a special performance at the Kennedy Center. Ham Jordan, who was a functionally Carter's chief of staff, he didn't actually take that title, Carter acted as his own chief of staff, but who was functionally assuming some of the executive duties in the White House, did not make the proper arrangements, and Tip O'Neill would not see his family in the first four rows, as he had asked. Jordan would claim it was an oversight, but O'Neill, the new speaker, took it as a slap against the old politics. It was the new Georgia people telling the old politician where he could go. O'Neill was livid. He told Ham Jordan, "I can shut you guys down for months." After a while, Hamilton Jordan did apologize, but O'Neill, even 12 years later, talking in his memoir, still referred to him as Ham Jerkin and said that for a chief of staff and a speaker, they barely met. Relations were awkward, and meetings were few. All of this culminated in some disapproval of the Carter administration's projects, especially his hit list, a list of dam and water projects that Carter, who was planning to balance the budget by 1981, wanted to get rid of. A lot of these projects were in members' districts, and the list came out without consultation with Congress. There was outrage among Congress, and Carter did tone the list down a bit, but still, his hit list went down in vote 247 to 177 in the House, an early defeat for the new president. Carter was a bit slow in his nominations, and his nomination of Atlanta attorney Griffin Bell raised some hackles. There were questions as to whether he had been a segregationist in the past. He also had some problems with CIA nominee Ted Sorensen, an aide to John F. Kennedy. While in the Kennedy White House, Sorensen had claimed to be a conscientious objector and so didn't register for the draft. Having this person as the CIA director was controversial, and Carter was forced to withdraw the nomination. Yet Carter was unfazed. He hurled legislation at Congress in 1977. Just a few of the proposals, a dramatic energy plan, including a gas tax, a tax on oil companies, executive reorganization, a creation of a consumer affairs agency, the water project cuts, ethics reform, hospital cost cuts, a Department of Energy. Everyone told me, Carter told his diary in 1977, not to take on too much. But it's impossible for me to delay when I think there's important work to be done. For a boost in the economy, Carter introduced a controversial plan to give everyone in America $50 and cut corporate taxes. That last bit infuriated Democrats and labor. Labor wanted $30 billion in public works programs, and they wanted a minimum wage hike of 70 cents. Carter agreed only to a 20-cent hike in the minimum wage when the AFL-CIO, as early as May 1977, just a few months in office, said Jimmy Carter had retreated from the positions he took in the campaign. Still, polls at the same time put Carter up high, and if the election were redone, Carter, according to the polls, would have beat Ford by well more than the margin he did. Yet the support of labor loosened, and that weighed on the new administration in the early going. Having launched the $50 rebate program and getting many Democrats on board, reluctantly, Carter made even more enemies when he decided to reverse his stance. The economy, he said, had improved enough, and we no longer needed the $50 rebates. He was afraid it might increase inflation. Said one congressman, "Those of us who supported this against our better judgment were convinced of it. Now to see the White House pull it away, it's an embarrassment." By the first 100 days, Carter had done little more than his economic reorg, some small energy changes, and amnesty for Vietnam draft dodgers, which was a campaign promise that Carter had made. But it was the kind of action that had as many supporters as it did strong detractors. Carter spoke to Congress in April 1977, launching his energy plan and calling it the moral equivalent of war. But his plan had 113 proposals, many of them controversial. The tax on oil companies, a gas guzzler tax on big cars. But energy was the big concern in 1977. Oil had risen from $6 to $12 a barrel. Doesn't sound like much today, was then. As we all got a picture of recently, when gas prices had been high, the rise in oil affected the price of everything. From gas to heating, from groceries to industry to airlines, it was the major cause of inflation. To emphasize the speech, Carter appeared in a fireside chat asking Americans to conserve. To emphasize his point, Carter wore a cardigan sweater. Like Ford's Whip Inflation Now program, this was one of the low points of the imperial presidency, and that was what Carter intended. But while some of his actions, like walking down Pennsylvania Avenue or using the name Jimmy, worked pretty well with Americans, the cardigan sweater did not play well. Even Richard Nixon, writing in his memoir in the 90s, said was impressed by the walk down Pennsylvania Avenue, but of the cardigan said, "People want a leader." The cardigan didn't make a second appearance. Carter did introduce something that's very common now in politics, two town hall appearances, which were very well received. Then came foreign policy. During the campaign, Carter searched for an angle to use against the incumbent president, Gerry Ford. A challenger and an unknown facing an incumbent president, naturally the advantage was Ford's on foreign policy. First, Carter attempted to attack President Ford for focusing too much on human rights in the Helsinki Accords, and not enough on raw competition with the Soviets. But later in the campaign, Carter found that the human rights issue actually worked for him. He won support both with liberals who wanted a more compassionate foreign policy for the U.S. and with conservative Republicans in some cases who distrusted the policy of detente with the Soviet Union that Henry Kissinger and Nixon and to some extent Gerry Ford had pushed and wanted to start to challenge the Soviets on their human rights policies, show how evil they were. It worked, at least for the campaign. When Carter arrived in office and sent his new Secretary of State, Cyrus Vance, to Moscow, he made two mistakes. For one, Carter made a big issue in statements about human rights in the Soviet Union. Secondly, Carter expressed his negotiating positions on arms control with the Soviets in public. The Russians were not dumb. If they accepted Carter's publicly stated positions, everyone would know that they didn't negotiate for more, even though the Politburo did not face election every 2 years like American House members. They didn't want to look weak. They had public relations considerations here. Leonid Brezhnev sent Vance home early, with no concessions at all. Already, in March 1977, Carter had his first major foreign policy flub. It was not so much that he got Moscow upset. Old Russia hands knew that this is a card Russia always played, pretending to be hurt by American statements. But it's that Carter and his people didn't see it coming. In May of 1977, Carter went to London, Paris, and Bonn, West Germany. And things went better than expected for the new American president, and he impressed the European allies. Even with Germany, where there was expected conflict, as the German Chancellor Schmidt did not agree with Carter's focus on human rights in the Soviet Union. He had a better than expected meeting. Like many U.S. presidents, Carter found solace abroad where there was conflict at home. In Korea, however, Carter had another flub. Looking to balance the federal budget, he saw the huge expense of troops on the Korean Peninsula, and he advocated removing 30,000 troops from South Korea, from the demilitarized zone. When the general in charge, General Singlov, said it would be unsafe, Carter fired him. Of course, that action invoked memories of the early 1950s when Truman fired MacArthur. Neither president was helped by taking on one of their generals. It hurt Carter in opinion polls. But it hurt even more when Carter ended up relenting and only removing 3,000, an insignificant amount compared to the amount of troops there. There was little Carter could do. Several key prominent Democrats, Sam Nunn, Hubert Humphrey, and others, opposed the removal of troops from Korea. Carter ran into resistance when he attempted to cancel the B-1 bomber project, which drew the ire of many Democrats in Congress. During Carter's visit to Europe in May, he also took time to go to Geneva to visit Syrian King Assad. He was attempting to forge relations among Middle East countries that America had not talked to before. But this sparked criticism and an angry reaction from Israel, and contributed to the hardline Likud policy winning their election in May. Carter's visit with Assad was one of the issues that Likud brought up. A Likud victory was perceived at the time as a sign that it would be much harder to bring Israel to the table in any kind of peace deal, although Carter would accomplish this feat in the next year of his presidency with the Likud leader Menachem Begin, who is known as a super hawk. In August of 1977, Carter had a bit of a victory with the passage of his energy plan, slightly watered-down version by Congress. Carter then set out to work on another plank on foreign policy, his deal with Panama, to turn over control of the canal to Panama. In the campaign, Carter had opposed this move, but as he became president, he saw the transfer of the canal to Panama as a way to show the friendliness of the United States to Latin America, and to avoid a conflict with Panama over the canal. Ronald Reagan had used the Panama Canal issue to savage Gerry Ford when Ford had talked about transferring even partial control or gradual control to the Panamanians. Now, the president was advocating turning over what many perceived to be American property to a foreign government. Carter would eventually get his Panama Canal treaty, possibly the cost of his presidency, and certainly at the cost of many Democratic Senate seats. In September, Carter had what is arguably one of the biggest setbacks of his presidency up until the Iran hostage crisis, and that is the troubles of his budget director, Burt Lantz. Burt was a Georgia banker and a good friend to the Carters, And he was a mild-mannered person that many respected. In fact, of the members of the so-called Georgia Mafia, Lance was one that Tip O'Neill liked the most. Lance soon got into trouble for failing to disclose that he owned shares in a bank that, as budget director, he had helped. It was then revealed that he got a loan with awfully good terms from a bank that he sat on the board of. The Washington establishment, the media attacked. Here was a good friend of Carter's, and the president defended him, appearing side by side with Lance in a press conference defending against the charges. He stood by him. But eventually, Lance would be forced to resign. Carter took it personally, and so did many of the members of the Carter administration from Georgia. They saw it as the Washington people out to get the Georgia people. Carter's defense of Lance would not help him in the eyes of the Washington establishment or the public. Carter had set a very high bar. He was the citizen president. He wasn't Nixon. He didn't think he was above the law, nor were his friends, and yet here he was defending a friend who seemed to be, by all measure, guilty of at least irregularities in the... And after the Lance affair, by September 1977, Citizen Jimmy, the president who had had a 75% Gallup poll rating, was now down to 50%. Said reporters Evans and Novak in their column, Jimmy Carter, the campaign whiz kid of 1976, was the political incompetent of 1977. More damning than the actual Gallup poll rating, which at many times during presidencies have gone up or gone down, is that when interviewed further, many Americans were saying they didn't believe this president could get anything done. The significance of this change is that President Carter would never go higher than 50% after that. He would never recover. His best months were the early months of 1977. Of course, he would have some successes. The meeting in Camp David, bringing together Egypt and Israel, development of the housing and urban development departments, and the education department, beating back in the last year of his presidency a challenge from Democrat Ted Kennedy, and as even his successor Ronald Reagan would admit, working diligently in every last day of his presidency to rescue the American hostages in Iran. Not doing it at a politically convenient time, but bringing them all home alive. But his presidency would also get a lot worse. The Iran hostage crisis. Gas prices, gas lines, horrible inflation and unemployment. Misery for many Americans. The economy between 79 and 80. The presidency of Jimmy Carter is an example of a phenomenon of American politics, the presidential honeymoon. The president is elected, conceivably with a large mandate, little bit of fear, little bit of respect from the Congress, and has a few months in which to achieve the maximum amount of their goals. It does seem that successful presidents accomplish things in the first few months, hence the example of the 100 days. Carter's story demonstrates that if those first few months are not handled well, a whole presidency may be in trouble. A couple of other notes about Jimmy Carter. He has, as many know, become one of the most successful ex-presidents in his involvement in his charity work with the Carter Center and on several diplomatic initiatives and monitoring elections in various places. He's almost improved his image. He has indeed improved his image as president, according to polls taken now, by the result of his post-presidential activities. He's matched by only Herbert Hoover. I also believe that given we experienced the year 2008, which was a time of very high energy prices, we understand Jimmy Carter in 1977 a little better now. All throughout the 80s, through most of the 90s, the early part of this decade, when you look back and read a textbook about the Jimmy Carter presidency and you're hearing about energy plans and why did this guy tell us to conserve? Why was he wearing that sweater? I don't think it was till recently when we saw gas prices in America reaching a level that was almost a limitation on where you could go, that you realized how crucial something like that energy plan was. And some of Carter's initiatives, for example, a focus on solar power, look awfully good now. might have been something that would have been good to get a start on in the late 1970s. So we can look at history, and we can certainly look at Carter in 1977 as not so much of a successful presidency and not successful politics, but you know, there are more dimensions to it. It's not clear that the Founding Fathers wanted the president to have what we now call a mandate. President, per the Constitutional Convention, was elected by the Electoral College, a group of supposedly wise men who would be picked merely for the purpose of selecting a president. The president was not originally elected by the people, though there was proposals for that at the Constitutional Convention. That's not what passed. The framers of the Constitution didn't appear to have anything like a mandate in mind. It was Andrew Jackson who started the concept of an election that produced a mandate, that gave the president, by being the representative of the people, the only person elected by the whole nation, a mandate to govern. Different presidents have viewed that different ways. Most presidents are with Andrew Jackson, but it certainly wasn't the way that Rutherford B. Hayes viewed the office. A president like a Grover Cleveland did not take himself so seriously as to think that he actually represented millions of Americans. He realized he was selected and did the job in a businesslike manner. Woodrow Wilson was more of a mandate president. He knew he'd been elected to accomplish goals, and he had no trouble in using his bully pulpit to push legislation through. Franklin Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, of course, in this category. Carter is indeed one of these presidents. Carter felt his election was a mandate. It was a mandate to change Washington from top to bottom. Unfortunately, he may have overestimated his mandate, and he certainly took on too much. In the early going, it seems that President Obama is very popular. He has a broad base of support. So far, his early programs have passed through Congress. We're still looking at a budget and health care plan coming down the pike. 1977 provides an interesting perspective on what could happen. It certainly doesn't mean it will. With History Beating Up Politics, I'm Bruce Carlson. I want to thank you for listening. The website is myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com. We have a page on Facebook. It's very great to see so many of the listeners joining up there. You just type in My History Can Beat Up Your Politics on Facebook, or there's a link to it on the site. Thanks for listening.